Ladies and gentlemen, and dear colleagues, some known, most unknown to me. When Durko, I was looking for you, now I found you, suggested I participated in this 2009 conference, I was, of course, very honored. You have done so much for the topic, and I think rightly so, it was mentioned yesterday. But to be honest, I was also very much challenged by the title you have chosen for this conference. How do we further the work of religious freedom? In my case, lawyers in Europe, how do we further the work of religious freedom? I can, of course, draw all the benefits from the input of Anastasia Crickley yesterday, and I will build upon her exposé. I do understand further in the sense of keep the best, what we have raised and realized so far, and improve where necessary with a view to safeguard everybody's freedom of conviction in a plural, ever plural, more plural, democratic surrounding. The time for speaking allocated is in terms of minutes, so I have to weigh, even count my words, I think. What do I say here, and what do I save for the paper? Let me start this way. Pluralization, heterogenization, increasing diversity of religions and convictions throughout Europe is an effect of at least three recent and simultaneous processes, and I will identify them in a minute. These three processes have induced a new type of social context in which freedom of religion, maybe more than ever before, might have become the challenge for the future if we wish to maintain peace in Europe and make of newcomers loyal citizens. Who are and what are these three processes? The first, and it's an increasing kind of degree of importance, the first is the extension of the European Union, and with it, new communities among us, the extension of the Council of Europe, and with it, new religious historical minorities among us. A second process, maybe even more important, is massive post-war labor migrations and more recently fluxes of asylum seekers and migrations on humanitarian grounds from all over the world. And last but not least, there is the increasing individualization of patterns of life and competition among growing numbers of worldviews, new religions, lifestyles, even religious and non-religious. As I said, they have induced a new type of social context. And I will speak here under the control of several European colleagues in the room, including the colleagues of new member states or of states to become a member of the EU. And I mention in particular John Taylor, who so knows well the world I will be dealing with in a few minutes. And I would like also to refer to Matthias Rohe, but I understand he did not yet arrive. I really greatly appreciate his work on these issues. And I will limit my talk to what, in my view, constitutes priorities, and I will call them challenges to be addressed, since the law, as it stands in most countries, does not have the appropriate answers to a number of issues as yet. And I would say I made up my own list. We can share views later today on whether I see it correctly, on whether I maybe have been forgetting a number of issues on the list, or maybe that you see it differently because of your views or other experiences. But prior to setting up such a list, what may be important, in particular out of respect for the non-Europeans among us here in the room, is to sketch the background and insist on a number of developments that make the issue of freedom of religion so sensitive, so explosive, I would say, and at the same time intricate to address properly. The main recent development is probably that humanitarian migrations I refer to have become by far more important in numbers than labor and economic, or what you call skilled migration. With the effect, I keep it short, but the effect is that the public opinion, on the average, does not welcome these migrations. They feel they are threatening welfare states. And policymakers, sometimes in a populist way, use these kind of xenophobic reactions of people instead of presenting things in a more nuanced way. And there we are. People who are vulnerable, who came on humanitarian grounds, are unprepared. They are extremely vulnerable. They lack, in the short run, perspectives of improving their chances to fully participate in new society at large. And religion, in these circumstances, becomes a refuge, a kind of security bell. It may even become an existential need to better cope with the sufferings of a minority position. Yesterday, I think, so rightly, Anastasia quickly said, how do we redistribute power and resources today? And I think the question is, including these people or excluding these people in this redistribution process? I think we should really not underestimate this dimension of religious revival in the contemporary setting in Europe today. Of course, most of you, this sounds familiar. Vulnerability combined with the potentials of religion and religious freedom, this is to be given the right to express it and live conformingly, is of course not new in history. Religious minorities are the very historical reason why, and in Europe since the Edict of Nantes in particular, religious freedom has been put on the agenda and ever further elaborated. And European governments rarely miss the opportunity whenever they get a chance to remember the world that they have been pioneers in the field of freedom of religion. And yet, it seems the legal techniques on hand to safeguard this freedom are facing new challenges and have true difficulties in coping with them. And what are these challenges? I count basically four, and I take 1 or 2 minutes for each one, so to save time for further prospective reflections. The first one is we are facing minorities, religious minorities in this case, in a globalized world. These people who have come keep bounds in the other country outside Europe, savings, kins, allegiances. These people compare what is the state granting to them, what are states granting to their people elsewhere. These people are very sensitive and they feel solidar with members of their church, of their belief in other parts of the world. This is what we call in anthropology, they form a community of suffering. All members of my community suffering elsewhere make me suffer. And since war situations are more the rule than the exception in the world, people identify with these situations elsewhere. This adds to the vulnerability, to the feeling of being a victim. People possess, in the meantime, very often simultaneous citizenships. They have acquired the citizenship of the country of the residence. Then is the question, which law applies to them? And this produces intricate questions. We call them in law positive conflicts of nationalities. Now, these are highly challenging questions in law, but the reality is that people, since they compare, since they keep these loyalties and allegiances, have the position that you could, in a way, put this way. If in the order of the state I'm living now, I'm not offered equivalent protection, I'll shop around for a better solution. I may go and shop around and look for a solution in my country of origin, or I may start setting up my own instances of dispute settlement, or just I ignore state law. This is very much the reality within which we are living in Europe. I think it's a new challenge. Minorities in a globalized world. The second fast challenge, human rights. As elaborated in human rights treaties, they are characterized by a number of what I would call weaknesses. Most human rights, including freedom of religion, are not what we call absolute. This means that you have to weigh, to balance, to ever compare them, whether they have priority over other rights, over other interests. And then is the question, how do you balance? Human rights have a kind of problem, and freedom of religion includes this kind of weakness. It's been formulated in very promising, in very general, open way, which creates very often high expectations, but that cannot always be met. And why do people then feel so vulnerable? Because they don't know what they can expect from these freedoms and where they can get the information and what they can expect from a specific human right in their case. And the case law indeed is very divided on the way to apply them. Within the legal order of each individual member state to the Convention of Human Rights and Fundamental Liberties in Europe, identical claims are addressed in divergent ways by different authorities, courts, and administrations. And this creates legal uncertainty. What can I expect from the law when it comes to my freedom of religion? Think of the headscarves. Think of the crosses in the courtrooms and in public buildings. Think of the constraints to freedom of expression in the recent cases of defamation or blasphemy. Think of religious marriages. Hundreds of cases over the years have been dealt with in ways that are sometimes not to be compared with one another. How come? Moreover, human rights are dealt with in adversarial proceedings. You have to fight for it. And you don't know the outcome. You don't know the outcome. This also is very much the case with the jurisprudence of the Court of Strasbourg, our human rights court. There is this uncomfortable feeling of a black box system. You know what you put in the claim, but you don't know what you can expect from the court. What will be the outcome? Now, this is partially due to the fact that the court has an immense respect for the specificities of the situation within each country. We call it the margin of appreciation. It leaves to the countries, in first instance, how they do appreciate the way you balance freedom of religion and the constraints you put to it, with the effect that you never know whether a court's decision, for example, a headscarf decision, is exportable to another country. It may well be that there the court will have another evaluation of the situation. So, divided jurisprudence within the national state orders, ad hoc approaches sometimes, very much case-to-case approach. The insecurity when it comes to the Strasbourg jurisprudence make people feel that freedom of religion is very much depending on judges who themselves appreciate the constraints of the freedom of religion in various ways. We call it in French le gouvernement des juges. The issue is in the hands of the judiciary. But who is the judiciary? And this is my third challenge. Lawyers so far, generally speaking, I don't speak for all, but generally speaking, are not prepared. They're not familiar with the religious backgrounds of newcomers in particular. And this may have a double consequence. On part of the court, sometimes the court prefers to ignore the background in order not to be misunderstood or give erroneous interpretations. And on part of the advocates, they sometimes do not double check some claims, or they instrumentalize some traditions or religious beliefs in terms of strategy of defense in court. They reduce religion to a strategy of defense, which either ridicules the defense or in the public opinion, reduces the image society gets from these communities, these minorities, to stereotypes, to untenable claims that clash anyhow with human rights requirements in their views. And what are these requirements? Reasonableness, legitimation, and proportionality in a democratic society. So the conclusion is, paradoxically speaking, when human rights, which count among the most promising instruments to balance freedom of expression and freedom of discrimination in a plural setting, as Anastasia Crickley so rightly summarized yesterday, if they are not complemented by instruments that offer more legal security, I think of increased expertise in the field of religion, professionalization of free legal clinics, free legal advice in this area to vulnerable parties, publication of relevant case law and in-depth comparative research, they produce the opposite effect. Disenchantment, profound disenchantment among religious minorities, bitterness even. And this bitterness counts probably among the most serious counterproductive effects that should be, we lawyers in Europe, our concern and count among our priorities. Since, as Chief Justice Langa so rightly underscored yesterday, the solution will have to come from the law. In democratic context, this means laws that have been openly discussed through careful examination of all interests at play and against the background of a concern also for minorities. I so much like the term bosberaad, discussed within society. Solutions have to come from the grassroots, bottom up. I would call it grassroots democracy. This for human rights. A last challenge I will just devote some minutes to here is the secular state. And the way we give this secular state its normative substance. Historically, secularism is to be seen as a way to handle pluralism. It was meant to protect religious pluralism by making sure that the state does not take a stand that would be to the detriment of other religious groups in society, and therefore state and its authorities need to be neutral from a religious point of view. In reality, however, as we all know, there is a gap between the principles and their application, and this is the case in most secular states. Secularism takes the form of a compromise with history. In some secular states, the head of the state is also the head of the church. In some states, secular states, the state funds religious education also in public schools, or it pays the salaries of the ministers of the cult. Or it keeps the Christian calendar as the standard reference for fixing holidays. Churches of traditional religions spread all over are not considered an anomaly in the definition of a secular public sphere. More recently, as I already referred to, we have the cases on the crosses in the courtrooms and in public buildings. They have raised interesting questions in this regard. What is our symbolic landscape? And are we also accommodating it with a view to give minorities access to this landscape? Minorities ever louder now contest these compromises with the past, or at least they wish to have a say on the way we keep legitimizing them. And our reaction very often is, our legitimation is our past, and the future, you have to negotiate it. Undoubtedly, the religious community that is raising the most critical question in this regard is Islam. Now, Islam, historically, has not developed for itself a univocal jurisdiction on how to handle on a large scale, the position of Muslim minorities under non-Muslim, in this case, secular law. For long, this position was seen as an exception. It was addressed, but in terms of an exception. Now, Muslim communities in large numbers are in this situation, and they will have to sort out for themselves how to deal with it, and they have to negotiate it. They will have to make also within the community a new compromise, and with the local authorities, how to handle, how to see their jurisdiction over them. Only they can do it. We have no legitimacy to decide for them. If I recapitulate what I see for us as challenges. How do we handle in law multiple allegiances in a globalized world? 2, how do we make sure that human rights offer indeed legal security and leave people less with the feeling, as is the case now, if it depends on human rights, it's either way. How do we redefine the secular state? And I'm so grateful. I have had a number of interesting discussions these last 2 days, and I got a chance to speak with the colleagues from Argentina. Argentina is redefining the membership to communities in their relationship to the state. I wish we hear from these experiences these days. I think in Europe we have to listen to these experiences because we are facing the similar difficulties. How do we define relationship between the secular state and the religions under its jurisdiction? For feeling unfairly treated, or put differently, not correctly understood, religious communities take reference to their faith, sometimes not as a conviction, but as an instrument of opposition, of contest to majority society, and in the meantime, of empowerment. Is that what we want to get at? I explained for myself the increasingly militant agenda behind some claims that are formulated in the name of freedom of religion, partly as the responsibility on part of the legal system that has shown so far too hesitant, divided, and insufficiently familiar with other religions to address even the most reasonable, legitimate, and proportionate claims. You refuse in an arbitrary way a reasonable claim for wearing the headscarf. You do, you may expect sooner or later, and we do have them now, women to claim the right to fully cover the face. You do not grant any recognition to religious marriage. People get married abroad or just turn their back to the civil jurisdiction. You do not grant any effect to religious arbitrage. People will stay just outside state courts. I could give you another number of examples. Am I dramatizing for the purpose of making my point here? Yes and no. If I'm honest with myself, of course, yes, because there are a number of wonderful examples to give of creative jurisprudence, and I'm not mentioning these examples here because I'm seriously concerned. Law, in my view, is losing its credentials if it does not, in the first instance, remain an instrument of protection of the weaker and the vulnerable. People have to feel protected by it in what matters to them. In return, they will put their expectations in the legal system and not outside the legal system. 2 minutes. Oh, that's generous on your part. So how do we set an agenda for the future? How do we further the work of religious freedom? There are two kinds of people in this room, of course, many more personalities, but basically academics and practitioners. They have each their own responsibilities. Academics, they can take some distance. Practitioners are pressed by urgency, but they should share the common concern for justice for all, while keeping an eye on social cohesion. Pluralism is to be organized within state law and not outside. Now, let me just stick at academics. What are we to do? I see several things. These are indeed times that are challenging our responsibilities. We should proceed to in-depth comparative research. We should make sure the practitioners, those who are pressed by urgency, have access to relevant case law. And I so welcome all these initiatives on databases. This is so useful. We should comment also these cases, and we should enlighten the successful experiences. We should engage in conferences like this and go for an as systematic approach as possible. 3 questions: what went wrong, where are we now, and set the priorities and elaborate new frameworks in agreement with the communities involved and that are relevant to them and to the practitioners. This means these frameworks need to be realistic and innovative at the same time. And I have no time, but I see 3 fields where we could really, in the short run, already work together. It's contracts law. And when I think in particular of Muslims in Europe, Islam and contracts law has a fabulous potential of emancipation within it, within the secular legal order. We could do a lot with Islamic contracts law. A second field, much more sensitive because it's been kind of over-mediatized, is dispute settlement. Judicial pluralism. Do we open some possibilities to settle the dispute outside our courtrooms, and how? And the third one is cultural defense in court. When do you use the argument of religion in the sense of defending the person? Religion, we should not be frightened. It is not a threat to secular state. If lawyers address it, and in due time, which means now, we can see it, I think, as a real opportunity. And I hope we go for 3 wonderful days.